The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
The book of Exodus tells the world's oldest freedom story. I think sometimes we forget that when we think of the Exodus only in terms of Disney and something to quieten the kids with animation. But it's an oldest freedom story that's profoundly changed the world. It tells a remarkable story of how a group of slaves were freed from the mightiest empire of the ancient world. But dig underneath that for a moment and you see an even more radical claim. That is that the all-powerful God who brought the world into being is the one who intervened in human history to save this people, to save these slaves, to save these weak, defenseless, powerless people against the mighty, against the ones who claim to have God in their side. In Egypt, power and God were firmly on the side of Pharaoh. The Pharaoh was the closest you could get to God. And that way of thinking that there was an established order in the universe, that the power of Pharaoh was the same as the power of the sun over the creation around, was just the given. It's no accident that in the ancient world so many of the rulers saw themselves as divine or as representatives of the divine intermediaries, certainly more than just humans like you and I. They ruled because they were gods or because the gods had put them in their place. They ruled over the earth in that way. The thought that God would intervene in a radical, revolutionary, upside-down way on the side of those at the bottom of the heap made little sense at all. And so with the Exodus, if it's accepted, you actually have a reworking of the moral universe. Paul Johnson, his great little book, The History of the Jews, describes and captures this well. Let me read just a bit from him. He says, "All the great conceptual discoveries of the human intellect seem obvious and inescapable once they've been revealed, but it requires a special genius to formulate them for the first time. The Jews had this gift. To them we owe the idea of equality before the law, both divine and human, of the sanctity of life, the dignity of the human person, of the individual conscience and of a personal redemption, of collective conscience and of social responsibility, of peace as an abstract ideal, love as the foundation of justice, many other items which constitute the basic moral furniture of the human mind." See, he's on the money there. And that way of thinking, I think you could capture it in shorthand as an Exodus way of thinking, because it gives a remarkable dignity to the human person. It speaks of an equality that was unknown before it. And it's more like a song, really, that echoes down through the ages and that it's been picked up by others who want to join in that chorus. That song that brought the nation of Israel into being, that said that they could only now understand themselves as God's freely chosen people who were chosen to be free. Whatever challenges they will face in their history, they've got this momentum that's been given to them by God to look forward to the promised land, to his deliverance. And so down through the ages, others have taken that up as well. Others who've fought against oppression, who've seen powers against them, have appropriated this kind of way of thinking to say that we too face our pharaohs. We too are ones who want to seek after freedom. You see that particularly down through, well, you can think about it all over the world, but in European history, you see it coming up in all sorts of interesting places. Certainly in the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, Martin Luther is cast again and again as the Moses figure against the Pharaoh who was the Pope. Now, I'm not saying that's what Egypt teaches, what Exodus teaches at all, but can you see the power of that narrative, of that song, that you need to sing in tune with it if you're going to have appeal to people, because they love what Exodus is teaching. So when the The Spanish Armada is sunk. It's seen, here is the act of God. Here is God blowing upon the waters, saving his people, just as he did back in Egypt to part the waters and to then close them again on Pharaoh's army. Here, as this commemorative medallion shows, is God blowing upon the waters, saving his people to be free from the terrible, evil Pharaoh that would otherwise have them. Cromwell used that same kind of language, saying to Parliament that his actions against the king were those that could only be paralleled by what had taken place in the Exodus. Jefferson and Franklin use it across in America as they want to say, rebellion to tyrants is obedience unto God. That's the great seal that they designed, you know. And so there's a very distinctively American way of thinking that appropriates this language. And not just at the margins of thought, but very much at the centre of it, trying to say this is who we are, this is what it means to be God's people in the world. It's to be free like this. Now, it's a powerful narrative, it's a powerful rhetoric. And of course, in America, for Jefferson and Franklin, it will backfire. Because the American complaints about, you know, this metaphorical enslavement to the British were heard by their slaves, who said, well, that metaphorical enslavement's interesting, but we're the actual slaves in this story, surely. And so the Negro church in the States brings up that same chorus and starts singing it in great spirituals that speak of, let my people go. They are profoundly moved by that narrative. The great trilogy of books that tell Martin Luther King Jr.'s story and the story of the American Civil Rights Movement rightly pick up the language of Exodus, of parting the waters, of the pillar of fire, of at Canaan's edge, language that's all come straight out of Exodus, but it's also used by the church at the time to say this is what it means to be searching after freedom. And then the night, that's a picture there of Martin Luther King preaching the night before he's killed. So there he is in Memphis. Famously at the pulpit there, he says, look, he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. I've looked over, I've seen the promised land, and I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. There he is, the last night of his life, speaking in words that seem so strangely prophetic of what was to happen to him in the very next morning. In fact, I hadn't known this, but 40 years later, as Obama comes, 40 years later, he's picking up the language of Exodus as he speaks to the black churches and says, they had 40 years in the wilderness before they come to the promised land. We're the Joshua generation. We're the ones who now are going to come into the land. And deliberately using that kind of language of Exodus in the most contemporary way to say, now is our time to be free. So Exodus is, yes, it's a story in the Bible, but it's one that has lived down through the ages and been so influential in shaping a cultural, political kind of understanding of freedom and saying that oppression is not just an inevitable thing. But it's not just political, and we can't easily separate the theological from the political. It is mixed up in this way because it forces us to think differently about the human condition. The enemies of Christianity have known this as well. So Nietzsche, in his condemnation of Judaism, describes it as a slave revolt in morals. You know, we can see what's up for grabs here. And this is not just a faraway story as well. It's a very Australian story. And to this I'm indebted, I was indebted to my friend Matt Andrews. I've just bought him a coffee, so I've paid off that debt. Thank you, Matt. But for that coffee, he was telling me the story of William Cooper, and there's a picture of William Cooper here, the great Aboriginal leader, Christian activist, and he again and again picks up that song of Exodus. His articles, his interviews are sprinkled with that story of Hebrew slaves and the Exodus, and In Melbourne today, the Jewish community down here, down there, call him the Aboriginal Moses. Matt and I have been to some Jewish community events where you walk in and there's a huge pull-up picture of William Cooper. He's a hero to them because of the work he did in speaking for the freedom of the Jews and the horrors of Hitler, you know, speaking for the rights of people who he didn't belong to. Because for Cooper, the ideas of the Exodus weren't just a metaphor. He knew all too painfully what it meant to be in slavery, what it meant to be taken to missions, to find some freedom there and to find some good things, to find safety, but also to know the experience where the women were sometimes effectively in sexual slavery, where the game were fenced off, where all sorts of other things were taking place. And it wasn't just William Cooper. It wasn't just an isolated thing. It was something that was very common as the evangelicals, as the Lutheran missionaries brought the gospel message to the Aboriginal people. Again and again, it was the Exodus story that was picked up in song. Found this even in a picture here of the Yarra tribe who reenacting one of the early photos we've got from 1862. This is what it looks like for the Aboriginal people to be under civilization, says the heading given by the photographer. But they're reenacting the Exodus. Here they are lined up and saying, we're on a march to the promised land. We're after freedom. Fascinating to see that. So over the next, well, it's not the next 4 weeks, but 4 weeks scattered over the back half of the year, really what we're going to do is dip into Exodus just a little bit. It's a magnificent book. It is one that's rightly echoed down through the ages and that has changed the world. We're only going to see little bits of it. But as we do, I want to say that this story is one that's profoundly shaped the past, but is living now in the present as well. And you see the story begin with the passage that we had read in Exodus 1, but it's part of a larger story. If we looked at the book before, in the book of Genesis, we see a book that begins with the creation of the world, but then quickly the back half of Genesis is a story of a family, of Abraham, who's promised that his family is going to be a blessing to all nations. And we see a family story that seems to go through all kinds of sagas until Joseph, remember Joseph and the coat, Joseph is sold down into slavery in Egypt. And as he's sold there, he goes through prison but then rises to power, and through his wisdom he's able to save his family, who then come down, saved from famine. And they become this great nation. There is a shift in Exodus 1 of a family story to the story of a nation. We start to see this fulfillment of that older story of God fulfilling his promises to Abraham. It seemed impossible back then, but here we start to see it being fulfilled. But even as it does, we see an immediate threat to it. Look at verse 7. Number 6 there in the outline. Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful. They multiplied greatly. They became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. Do you get the point there? Fruitful, multiplied greatly, exceedingly numerous. The land was filled with them, right? Big families. Too big. It's too big to describe as a family anymore. We're talking about a nation. But as that change happens, and as Joseph and his generation die, a new king arises, verse 8, who didn't know about Joseph, who comes to power. And his assessment of it isn't informed by what had taken place back there in Genesis. Instead, he just looks out and sees a threat. He says to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. We must deal shrewdly with them, although we'll become even more numerous. If war breaks out, they'll join our enemies, they'll fight against us and leave the country. You don't come to be the leader of a superpower like Egypt without having some political nous. And here he is, understanding exactly the threat that could come. And he makes a political judgment that they've become too numerous. It's a very Egyptian way of thinking. It's about power, and it's about seeing threat, and it's about acting shrewdly when you see it. And so he comes up with a plan, which is to effectively enslave the Egyptians. That's what he'll have them do. Verse 11, he puts slave masters over them. He presses them with forced labor. They built these store cities. But it doesn't work. Verse 12, the more they're oppressed, the more they're multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. They work them ruthlessly. There they are, having to make bricks and mortar and suffering as slaves. But his plan doesn't start there. Instead, there's this horrible, evil twist, verse 15, of slow genocide being disclosed as his plan. He tells the Hebrew midwives there, and they might be Egyptian midwives who helped the Hebrews give birth. That might be how it works. He tells them, what I want you to do is to kill the boys. As the boys come out, then you're to kill them, for they're the ones who will be the threat. If it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. But the midwives, however, feared God. They didn't do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. And the king of Egypt summoned them and said, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwife answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous to give birth before the midwives arrive. I mean, that would never survive cross-examination. Would it? We don't believe it for a moment, but God is kind to the midwives. And the people increased and became even more numerous. Because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. See, there's this fascinating account here that opens this freedom story, which is about people who are fearful of Pharaoh, but even more fearful of God. This is a foundational kind of text for civil disobedience, you know, for those who would say you can't just obey the powerful and the ones who tell you to do things which are immoral. These midwives are the ones who are the great heroes. And this is an introduction to that different way of thinking about the law, really. See, the law comes and tells them to do a certain thing, but they say, no, there's a greater responsibility we owe than the law. It's really a question here in this simple little tale of what the moral limits of the state are. It's not Rex Lex. The king is the law, Pharaoh is the law, just do whatever he says. It's Lex Rex. The law of God is king. There are moral laws higher than the state. This is an Exodus way of thinking about law and politics. It's not an Egyptian way. See, in this deceptively simple little tale at the start of Exodus, we get really a picture of where the whole book is going to take us, to say that freedom is going to come as the rulers who want to live independently of God and ignore him are held to account. Until modern times, that's a very radical thought, that rulers would have anything but absolute authority. Certainly Pharaoh would have felt that way. Bringing the midwives before him, he wouldn't have asked them what they thought about the law and whether it was right or not. He just wanted to know whether they'd done it. Moral limits to power sounds like treason. But here we have a story about slaves being freed. And it's given, though, as the start of a story that talks about how God is going to save these people who are slaves. Pharaoh isn't stopped by the action of the midwives. Pharaoh gives the order to all his people, every boy that's born you must throw into the Nile, let every girl live. He's committed to this genocide. And yet, if we read on, and we don't have the passage there in front of you, but in chapter 2 you see the birth of Moses described, and might know the famous story of how he's saved in the bulrushes, and he's there in this little ark kind of basket. And God hears the prayers of his people. It says it says there that as the king of Egypt dies, Israelites groan in their slavery. They cried out. Their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God, and God heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob, and God looked on the Israelites and was concerned on them. See, the answer to the prayers is actually in this way that he will save this little baby Moses. He's going to go on to lead the people out of slavery. It's a very unexpected way. He doesn't come with an alternate ruler with power that will smash down the empire. Instead, from within the empire and in the middle of the oppression, he subverts it all with a baby, with the birth of a baby. The opening scenes here where God does that, and it's a fulfillment of the covenant promises, find, of course, there's the Hebrew midwives, Moses and the baby, find, of course, a parallel in the birth of Jesus, who also is born at a time when the people are under oppression, who also faces a tyrannical king, Herod, who is terrified of losing power, and so comes after the infants, wants to massacre all the boys under two at the time in order to make sure that no rival king will arise. But God saves the baby, and they flee to Egypt. And out of Egypt, God will call his son, just as he called his people, Israel. The connections there are so deep, so interesting, so many parallels that take place that will go on through the life of Jesus, the one who will spend 40 days in the wilderness, mirroring the 40 years in the wilderness that God's people did, the one who will feed and water the people of God in the desert, just as Moses did, the one who will take the people up onto a mountain and explain to them what God's law is all about and how it is that they're to live. See, Jesus sings the Exodus song, that freedom song, like no one else ever has, and shows us what it means to live and die for that song. But I think perhaps most strikingly, he comes to save people and to bring them to freedom in a way which is the very opposite of Egypt. Instead of coming as the one with all power and might and looking like a god covered in gold and wanting to establish his order and crush it down on the universe, he comes from below. He comes as a slave. He just dies a despised death. Now, this isn't the kind of cute Jesus bit that the preacher tacks on at the end of the sermon. This is actually saying that that way of thinking is actually how God reveals himself to the world, not in power and glory, but in humility. It overturns the moral fabric of the universe. It makes us think very differently about how it is we're to live. And we might question some of the ways that that narrative has been appropriated through the years, where Christians have wanted to say, oh, yes, we're striking against Pharaoh. But there's other times when we say it is right. It is wonderful to see that. And we think, well, what is the alternative? There's a lot of talk today about moving into a post-Christian world. And I think if we're doing that, we need to think what a pre-Christian world looks like, what a pre-Exodus world looks like, and to think, what's the alternative? What does it look like to have Egyptian values, to say that it's just all about power? It's all just about being able to establish what your identity is against others. So it is just a teaser today. It's one that's designed to have you open Exodus for yourself and to read it. But we've got a few moments now for questions. Pete's going to give us some instructions. But if you want to start scribbling questions, that'd be great. Okay. As always, brilliant questions here and more coming. Some of you have atrocious handwriting. It's always the speaker's way to get out of the difficult questions, isn't it? Sorry, I can't read that one. Is the something... Oh, lesson. Is the lesson of Exodus 1:8, the forgetting history, is the beginning of tyranny? So 1:8 says, a new king came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous. So he doesn't know of Joseph in the past. Yes, there's an insight that we will see next week in the conflict between Pharaoh and God. We'll see that through. So the new pharaohs of 2019 forget that our civilization, our legal culture, was based on Judeo-Christian norms. Nothing in secularism can replace or even supplement them. Yeah, it's interesting. I would say even that secularism itself is in some ways, it's still a Christian way of thinking. It's not actually as true to itself as it needs to be if it's going to be consistent. We'll come to that next week as we think about what some of the alternatives are. But yes, protesters singing Hallelujah to the Lord in Hong Kong. Are they singing the same song? I'm not sure if you've seen the videos which have been doing the rounds, but one of the marks of what's taken place in Hong Kong from the protest society is the lack of violence, mostly, and a singing of this one particular song that's big in the church there, Hallelujah to the Lord, praise Yahweh. Christian leadership there has been significant in some of the events which are taking place in Hong Kong. I haven't spoken to people who've been there, but I've spoken to Chinese friends in Sydney who say that is true. That is something of what's taken place. And it's interesting that I think it does that decision for non-violence, the appealing to a Lord who is above the rulers before them, those are markers of ways that Christians have acted in the past. And not all revolutionary kind of history is like that. If you go back to the English Civil War, if you go back to the American War, you see a conscious kind of echoing of the, rightly or wrongly, you see a very deliberate conscious echoing of the Exodus and people saying, we're looking to the Bible, we're wanting to live as God's faithful people, this is what it looks like. For these reasons, we are rising up against the tyrant. Not all revolutions have been like that. There have been other revolutions which have said religion is part of the problem, the Bible is part of the problem, we need to rise up against it. And so the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution would style themselves like that. Interesting that as complex as history is, it's not as simple as doing what I'm about to do, but if you look back to the English Revolution, the English Civil War, the American Revolution, you see this enormous explosion of liberty talk, of rights, of the rule of law, of what that looks like. If you look back to the French Revolution, you see the guillotine. You see blood on the streets. You see the Russian Revolution. You see the gulags. You see terrible things taking place. Now, I would say it's because there isn't that appeal to Exodus, but instead an appeal to Egypt, an appeal to power to overthrow evil, and therefore the revolution eats itself and they end up doing that to others. So if Hong Kong is going to look different, it's going to have to be in an Exodus tune. Is that happening? Let's pray that it is. How did God design Israel's legal structure to push their newfound freedom towards liberty rather than licentiousness? How can we do the same as lawyers? Yeah, interesting. We'll come to that as we get hopefully to the third and fourth talks to see that freedom in Exodus is not just a freedom from Pharaoh, but a freedom to serve God. There's a fascinating thing that as the law is given in the back half of Exodus, it's almost like a voluntary slavery to God that takes place, that people choose to be his, and therefore they're to set up a civilization and a system of law which is based around freedom and love as its foundation. So that's a comeback, and we'll talk about that more. Does the command be fruitful and multiply echo today? Does a government's one-child policy offend this command? Be fruitful and multiply picks up the language that's given to Adam and Eve back in Genesis, and it's part of the ruling of the world that takes place. I remember one wise old Christian lady who said to me once, Michael, it's full. fill the earth. But there is something there that says, look, part of the way that we rule over this creation is that we that we care for it, that we actually look to raise the children, to raise the next generation. And part of Exodus is going to be telling them this freedom story. They're to tell these children, tell their children, their children's children, what's taken place. And even as this group of slaves will die in the desert, it's going to be their children that go into the promised land. So there's a lot of things that are happening there. Does a government's one-child policy offend this command? Yeah, I think it's the government, maybe not even the one-child policy, it's that the government is stepping in and doing that is an overreach of the state, I'd say, and asking it to do things which will offend. But perhaps even worse is where it's not the state doing it, but people voluntarily doing it. I'm not sure if you've come across the extinction movement, but people who've said the greatest threat to this world is human population, therefore we're voluntarily not going to have any more. So we choose not to breed anymore, and there's no hope there for the future. There's no thought that there is something more, and so there's a culture of death that takes place. That would be a different expression of it. How are we going for time? I can't even see. Pete. 1 minute. Sorry, we're not going to get through all these. Can you discuss liberation theology and whether it's a balanced approach or one that places humans' conceptions of freedom ahead of God, but using theology to do so? So liberation theology comes up in the 1960s in South America. And again, it very strongly is picking up the language of Exodus. And it sees it picks up Marxist thought as well. So it's big on social structures and institutions being the source of evil, and they need to be overturned. It's not survived, like it's kind of died out as South Americans went instead for a prosperity of charismatic Pentecostal kind of theology. And the Catholic Church has changed in South America as part of that as well. The interesting question with liberation theology is you've always got to think, who's the sinner that's saved in it? So who's the sinner in liberation theology? Well, it's got to be the oppressive capitalist overclass, you know. Are they saved by the gospel of liberation theology? No, they're judged and condemned. There's a weird kind of inversion of some of the things that a Christian about God wanting people to turn from sin and be saved, and instead just a kind of a vindication of the poor, which is not what Exodus is talking about. It's not just that taking place. Happy to pick that up more one-to-one if you want to, whoever asked that question, and for the ones not answered.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.